So today is bread service. We have four different offerings here from different members of our congregation. They're going to tell us about them, and we will bless them by listening to their stories. And then during our social hour, we will share in eating all of these offerings. Our first speaker, our speakers are Linda and Bruce McPherson.
Much of our family life centers around food. I'm not much of a cook myself, but I do enjoy baking quite a bit. And when Linda and I first met, we found that our skills and interests went together nicely because she is an excellent cook. 5 years ago, Linda began finding that gluten made her joints swell. This new condition has greatly tested my baking skills, particularly with regard to breads. Gluten is the protein found in wheat and several other grains. It gives wheat-based breads their wonderful texture and elasticity. There are a wide array of grains that don't contain gluten, and there are many gluten-free recipes available to use them. Unfortunately, in my experience, those recipes yield breads that usually have the mouthfeel of sawdust. So I did some experimentation and developed this bread. It contains oat, millet, teff, and tapioca flours. Although far from perfect, this bread has a pleasant texture and nourishes our whole family. Now, with some sense of irony, I'd like to say a few words in praise of gluten. With the rise in sensitivity to gluten in recent years, wheat and gluten have been demonized in some nutritional discussions. Some people say that not only is wheat bad for some people, it's bad for everybody. Certainly there are many, including my wife Linda, who must avoid it. But I would like to add some perspective. For the vast majority of human existence, our primary nutritional concern has been famine, not obesity. I would argue that those of us with European or Middle Eastern heritage owe a debt of gratitude to wheat. For it was wheat, gluten-filled and calorie-rich, that meant the difference between starvation and life to our ancient ancestors.
So what does this bread and my husband's act of making it mean to me? The autoimmune disease that is the source of my avoidance of both dairy and gluten and also requires that I avoid all nightshades, tomatoes, potatoes, eggplant, and any kind of chili or bell pepper is a very tall order. Those dietary restrictions often push me to a place where I feel very alone and deprived, a place where it can easily feel my life is lacking in abundance. Rather than being consumed by those feelings, I have chosen to direct my energy into becoming a truly amateur cook, which is how I would describe my cooking. Our minister, Craig Morrow, reminded me recently that while we think of an amateur as a sportsman, defined in the dictionary as a person engaged in pursuit without payment, the roots of the word are actually from the Latin amare, meaning to love. So I engage in this pursuit as an act of love, and I experience my husband baking me this gluten and dairy-free bread as an act of love. When it comes to this bread, or even the act of cooking for my family, it is the visible part, the active preparation, cooking, and serving that is usually the most greatly appreciated. However, it is easy to miss or not think about the layers of preparation, thought, and intentionality, and indeed love, that goes into making that performance happen. The time spent in planning a menu, writing a grocery list, doing the shopping, thinking about that food and how it will make me and my family or my friends happy. I invest a lot of that kind of invisible energy into food because it takes me to a feeling of abundance and plenty rather than one of deprivation and poverty. It is this layer of love that I am reflecting on this morning and would like to acknowledge. This same kind of work goes into this congregation. There is so much work we do see. All the setup, cleanup, ushering, religious education, the social hour snacks, the music, and more. Since joining the worship committee this past summer, I've had the opportunity to see some of the less visible work as well. And I'm simply amazed at the amount of love that pours into this congregation to make this gathering happen every Sunday. At its deepest level, I believe we are a congregation of amateurs pursuing our faith with love. I suspect and hope that the people who are doing all that work do it for the same reason that I do, that work for my family. It fills them up or nurtures their spirit. They do it not for recognition, but for love. I wanted to take a moment this morning to invite you to reflect upon and really look for and acknowledge the places where all that work, both the visible and the less visible, is happening. I, for one, am feeling immensely grateful that it does. Thank you.
And our next speaker is Dion.
What I have for you all is a loaf of bread from olive bread from Grand Central Bakery. I cook, but I do not bake. At least not bread. I wanted to bring a loaf of bread that was emblematic of my life here in Portland, which Grand Central Bakery, it's a little shishy, do I want to bring it? But last Wednesday I was walking down Woodstock Boulevard doing errands. I had to pick up a loaf of bread for Thanksgiving, and there it was in the window. Couldn't resist it. So this is the same kind of bread that I brought home to my home for Thanksgiving. Is it not closer? Better? Okay, sorry. And Thanksgiving is emblematic of my life in Portland. I moved here a little over four years ago with my youngest sister. I'd been living in Chicago alone. She'd been in Santa Monica alone since the death of her husband. I'd been spending time with her, but I didn't want to move to Los Angeles, and she didn't want to move to Chicago, and in conversation it came out Portland was a place we were both kind of interested in. So we took a trip out here, and we decided to move here and buy a home together. And we got here at the end of October, camped out in an empty house for a while. When the time came Thanksgiving, we were putting our home together, and we cooked Thanksgiving dinner together. And this was the first time that I had celebrated Thanksgiving in my home in over 30 years. And we've done it every year since. For the last 3 years, my Uncle Ron has joined us since his wife Miriam died of lung cancer. Shortly after, he lives in Gresham. But it's family in a way that I hadn't experienced before. And I really, it means something. Since I moved to Portland, it's also the first time that I have belonged to a religious congregation in about 30 years. I moved here, I knew I'd be working from home, and I was looking for ways to engage with people, and I visited here and pretty much never looked back. People talked to me, brought me in. Mabel, where's Mabel? Bless your heart, Mabel. She welcomed me. So that's it. Olive bread, Thanksgiving. Thank you.
Thank you, Dion. Our next offering comes from Matthias.
Okay, so I'll be displaying that a little later. So, hi everyone, my name is Matthias. A week ago, I was lying in bed, awake before getting up to come here, and I was stewing in dread about having committed to share today here about my experiences with bread. I agreed to do this after much hesitation. Anders is really good at cornering me at coffee hour and getting me to do things. I pushed myself to volunteer out of my typical strange combination of healthy impulse to lean into discomfort and very poor ability to set any boundaries relating to my own self-care and well-being. I had been procrastinating, but the dawn of the last weekend before bread communion felt like an irrevocable deadline to set my mind to the task of making sense of my experience. Why the dread? I didn't know until I forced myself to think about it, but once I did, it became pretty immediately obvious this was somewhere I'd been before. I've always felt a little alienated from the idea of family traditions or family culture of any kind. My parents have always been loving and supportive, almost always in a direct, practical, unsentimental way. It's just always been pretty low on what I see as the window dressing of family life, the traditions, the rituals, the things you do with your family just because that's what you do every year or even every once in a while marked by specific circumstantial triggers like play Monopoly by candlelight when every time there's a power outage or something like that. Sounds like something people would do, huh? Not that we never did any fun stuff as a family, it was always just kind of in a one-off sort of way, like experimenting with it because that's what we knew families were supposed to do. Like take, for example, making Christmas cookies, you know, with sprinkles and star and Christmas tree shapes. Like picture one of those commercials where they depict like a product that's going to like help, you know, give you all these great family, you know, parent-child moments by making cookie and easy and fun. You know, like me sticking my pudgy little hand down the cookie cutter and mom helping me to press it down just right. Then me looking up and clapping my hands in glee and excitement and collapsing into a little hug as a voiceover, you know, commercial slogan for Pillsbury cookie dough tubes plays. It's still pretty much what I picture whenever I hear about families that bake bread together. It's not like a judgmental thing. It's just like my only point of reference, kind of. My mom used to talk every once in a while about the lavish Sunday dinners her dad would make. I remember the specifics, but, you know, the classic stuff like ham, the proverbial roast, or like au gratin potatoes. Her mother got married young, and, her dad died when she was about 10, and by all accounts, that was a huge shift from this status quo. Her mother got married young and never really learned how to be self-sufficient. She struggled to take care of my mom and her three siblings. My impression, mostly from stuff my mom's written, is that this was pretty tough from there on out. They never really had quite enough. My grandma, manifesting maybe the only survival strategy she had, brought in a parade of men, none of whom stuck around, but some of whom may have left their mark on my mother in traumatic ways she's only alluded to. My mom, a hospice nurse by trade, has always shown her love by acting as a caregiver and provider in very concrete senses of the words. This may be understandable after experiencing that trauma of a household where basic health and nutrition needs weren't guaranteed. She was never domestic in that warm and fuzzy TV commercial way. Her focus has always been on cleanliness, sterility, the avoidance of disease. Maybe this is why she never relished cooking or baking. It's just unnecessary stress. Like anything involving eggs is like code red. In nursing terms, it would be contact precautions. Like we weren't really even allowed, like if we spilled like a tiny bit, like the whole countertop would have to be sterilized by rubbing alcohol, you know. So we pretty much just like avoided it altogether. On the other hand, some aspects of my childhood come across as like cartoonishly idyllic. I was just telling a totally odd friend, like AWAD, not ODD, I realize that's... how every day through high school, I had a lunch packed full of little healthy items from the store, stuff like granola bars, applesauce, fruit, little yogurt cups. She still kind of does this. Every time I visit, I'm deluged by an array perfectly balanced between healthy and responsibly indulgent of plastic sealed food items from Trader Joe's. You can imagine how most people react when I used to complain that my mom wouldn't stop overloading me with delicious store-bought food items, creating unnecessary plastic waste, and spending unnecessary money, when really I just wanted to have a conversation, connect as human beings, not as caregiver and object of care. So my bread today is almond poppy seeds, like I guess it's technically a loaf, but it's not in a loaf bin, but you know what I'm talking about. It's from a box mix, actually. That was another manifestation of this sort of hyper-practical caregiving style, that balance between prudent consideration my sister and my nutritional needs, and a desire to give us, and probably her, you know, the sweet indulgent things of which her living situation as a kid too often deprived her. So for a period of like 8 years, we about monthly would find one of these sitting on the dining room table, typically on a Saturday morning, always with the extra loving touch of chocolate chips baked in there, which are in this one. I dreaded sharing today because my experience with bread doesn't look like that commercial I talked about, but as I lay there a week ago mulling over what to bring, it hit me that this is my bread. I'm tearing up a little. This is my tradition, just as real as any other, imbued with its own type of love. Thanks, Mom.
Thank you. And our final offering comes from Lynn.
Thank you, Anders. When Anders asked if I would give a story about bread making, I said, Anders, I'm not the one to ask. I said, I'm a terrible bread baker. I've tried and I've failed. I said, but wait a minute, would donuts work? And he said, sure. So this is my story about my family years ago making donuts. Mind you, this happened many years ago when I was married. My husband and I had purchased a house around 1970 that overlooked a harbor in southeastern Massachusetts. It was a house that was originally built as a summer cottage by a very wealthy family in Philadelphia. And this was 1905. And evidently, by the construction of the house, they must have arrived every summer with an entourage of servants. And to put you in the space of the kitchen, I might describe some of the areas around there for you to get a better inkling of what happened in donut making. Over the kitchen, there was a wing that was called the servants' wing. And there were four bedrooms down off of the long hall with one bathroom with a club footed bathtub. And over the bathtub on the wall were five towel racks with five different soap dishes above the towel racks. And then downstairs in the kitchen, which was a collection of rooms, in the back there was a laundry room with about four or five different soap stone sinks. And there was a flower cutting room off at the one side of the kitchen. And there was an ice storage room. And then there was a pantry. And then finally in the middle of all of that was the kitchen. Now the kitchen had remaining a coal burning stove that was originally, it must have been built intact in the kitchen in parts, is it was big. And fortunately for us, we purchased the house around the time of the energy crisis. And there was enough coal left in the storage. So we fired that up and it heated this whole area for us. However, we did take down the wall between the pantry and the kitchen and made it much more of a family room. But that coal-burning stove was the warmth of our kitchen. And if we didn't cook on it or warm croutons on the top, there were always mittens and scarves and hats, you know, heating on the top of the stove after the snow sled riding. And that was usually the time that we gathered to make donuts. And knowing that it was going to snow the next day, we would scurry around and make up the dough for the next day to make donuts. So after the kids came in from sledding and whatever, we were ready. And reflecting on this time, it was interesting for me to see how much of a community-based activity this was, that everyone had their job, so to speak. My oldest daughter would roll out the dough on the big breadboard and cut it. My husband would stand over the pot of boiling fat to be sure the temperature was right with the thermometer in it. And just at the right time, Laurie, my oldest daughter, would bring the donut dough over, put it in the fat, and I was responsible to turn it after each side was golden. And then Christy, my youngest daughter, would stand anxiously with her paper sack filled with sugar and cinnamon, and the donuts